Reading from 1 John. We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another. How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need, and yet refuses to help? Little children, let us love, not in word or speech, but in truth and action. And by this we will know that we are from the truth, and will reassure our hearts before him whenever our hearts condemn us. For God is greater than our hearts, and God knows everything. Beloved, if our hearts do not condemn us, we have boldness before God, and we receive from God whatever we ask, because we obey God's commandments and do what pleases God. And in this is God's commandment, that we should believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another, just as God has commanded us. All who obey God's commandments abide in God, and God abides in them. And by this we know that God abides in us, by the Spirit that God has given us. Grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, John appears to be hunting big game today, perhaps the favorite target of everyone sensitive to religious excesses. As I said last week, I don't know of any studies, but just going on my own experience, I'd be willing to bet that it's the most frequently cited reason for giving up on Christianity, either leaving the church or deciding never even to start up. Sure, there are some people will say that the problem of evil is what sits atop the list. And, you know, folks will mention the church's irrelevance in a modern scientific culture. But for my money, you'd have a hard time beating hypocrisy as the favorite choice of the religiously disenchanted. So when John says, little children, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth and action, it seems he's on the trail, about to bag the big one. Pretty clear what he's getting at, isn't it? Word and speech occupy the realm of the fluffy and the insubstantial on this reading. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Show me a sermon. Don't preach me one. Right? Conventional wisdom in some circles has it that the church is populated by hypocrites. People who've got the whole word and speech part down, but are a little light on the truth and action. I was in middle school. We got a new student from Detroit. His name was Wesley. And Wesley, he was a nice guy. We liked him a lot. But man, he really told a lot of whoppers. He said he was related to Magic Johnson and that he played pickup ball in the summertime with NBA players and, that kind of stuff, right? So one day, Wes is late to school I said, where you been? And he said, well, man, it was awful. I was walking to school like I always do, and I looked up, and there's this red Ferrari coming straight at me like 100 miles an hour. And I didn't have time to do anything, so I jumped straight up in the air, and that car went right under me. But the thing is, I didn't get quite high enough, and it clipped my heel, and I flipped like 3 times and wound up in a ditch. And I'm not sure how long I was there, but when I finally woke up, I was kind of wobbly, but I knew I had to come to school, so here I am. And he said, well, where are the marks? I don't see any marks. You mean you look fine? Yeah, well, I got hurt mostly on the inside, where the marks don't show. It's awful. You ever know anybody like that? So many stories, too good to be true stories. As far as this is kind of hard to believe them, isn't it? The first question that pops into your head is, wait a minute, how do I know that's true? I mean, anybody can say that stuff, right? The world's full of people claiming to be something they're not. Talk's cheap. You don't get to be that interesting in my mind until I see a little proof. We learn how to negotiate the world more or less in precisely this fashion. And it starts early. You remember, you know, you're on the playground, and there was this kid who's always your rival. There was some kind of competition going on. Unlike many adults, for whom the response to rivals is passive aggression, kids haven't quite yet learned the subtle nuances of that form of attack and are completely satisfied with just plain old active aggression, right? I'm faster than you. I can draw better than that. And what's a standard reply to the old, my old man can beat up your old man strategic assault? I mean, how do you answer that when you're a kid? Oh, huh? Prove it, right? So when John throws out the truth and action over against words and speech, I mean, we kind of figure that he's calling Christians on their commitments. Prove it, John says. And that's just it, isn't it? I mean, on a casual reading, it looks like he's merely saying, look, refrain from being a hypocrite. It's more important to do it than to talk about it. And to be honest, I got some sympathy for that reading. Except, of course, when it applies to me. But for everybody else, I'm really pretty hip on that. But you know what I'm saying, right? I mean, Gandhi said famously, be the change you want the world to see. The implications of which is, don't just talk about doing something or changing something. Do it. So I'm sold. Part of my job as a minister is to convince people that's true. And we've got things that need doing out there in the world. And I'm supposed to persuade you to do them. On the other hand, I also get paid to sort of muck about in the garden of words and speech. So I don't want to walk exclusively down the other side of the street. In fact, I'd make the case that words are a form of action in some sense. I mean, I believe that words do things. They don't just fill the space between our mouths and our ears. In Hebrew, the word dabar stands for both word and act. So when God speaks a word in Jewish scriptures, for instance, God has already acted. When God says, I will bless you, God's not saying, I intend at some point to bless you, all things being equal, and the transmission problems on my Dodge Omni don't turn out to be serious. Rather, for God to speak a word is already to have that word realized, enacted, alive, moving. Think incarnation. Think Jesus. See, because Jesus stands right smack in the middle of what John's trying to say in our text for this morning. Rather than merely arguing against hypocrisy, I mean, who after all would argue in favor of it? I think John is driving at something else. Notice the parallel construction of verse 18. Word and speech get set against truth and action. In other words, John opposes word and truth and speech and action. Now, I mean, of course, we get the whole speech versus action part. The hypocrisy clause, as I call it. What seems less clear is the word versus truth part. I mean, in the binary word, truth, word obviously means falsehood. That is to say, John's not coming down on words in general as necessarily inferior to action, but rather, I think he's saying something like words that are spoken falsely. What kind of truth is John after? What kind of action would qualify, at least on John's reading of things, as truth? Well, I think, simply put, according to John, those actions are true that are loving. We act in truth when we act in love. Now, we hear that, and we say, rightfully, I think, all right, but so loving in what sense? Love how? Because, I mean, we live in a culture that has systematically worked love over. From love is all you need to what's love got to do with it. Right? From love is the answer to love stinks. So we may be forgiven for wondering just how it is that love answers the question about truthful action. I mean, after all, a lot of horrible, unspeakable things are done in the name of love, aren't they? People kill and manipulate and abuse, claiming love as the motivation. So love as a sort of generic principle proves less than satisfactory as a set of moral guidelines. But John doesn't let love stand alone, a word without content. He puts some flesh on it. We know love by this. Now, Jesus laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for others. According to John, we aren't to love falsely by saying pretty things while living another way. We love in truth and action, the way Jesus did, which is to say, sacrificially, sold out, all in. We follow Jesus in offering up ourselves to be used by God for God's purposes rather than our own. I mean, it's not enough to avoid hypocrisy by acting in incongruence with our words. That is, it's not enough just to be who we say we are. That's important. Moreover, we're not just trying to be loving by some broad definition of human niceness. Rather, we're trying to be loving in the way Jesus was loving. The truth we're after is not the truth of love defined as generally the way the world defines it, in a million different ways, most of the roads of which lead inexorably back to me, my grasping, clutching self. The truth we're after is the truth of love demonstrated in Jesus, who gave himself up, who laid his life down. And all of this might remain at the level of abstraction if we left it just there. I mean, it'd be possible, if that was always said, to leave here feeling sort of edified, having been exhorted to lay down our lives like Jesus laid down his life. Well, that's nice. Well, that's nice, dear, but well, what's for lunch? But see, John's he's not satisfied with abstraction. Not content to let us feel affirmed in our determination to live quiet, honest lives, uncontaminated by controversy or expense. John gets particular. How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses to help? Ouch. Now, you give most preachers enough time and we'll find some wiggle room in there for you. But I got to tell you, this one's hard. John doesn't seem to be opening things up for a long series of qualifications. It doesn't look like he's saying, oh, you know, I would help, but, I mean, you know, the kids have oboe lessons and the in-laws are coming over for the weekend and I mean, the Dow's down, and if things don't improve, we're going to have to wind up selling the second house and dip into savings to keep up the mortgage payment. And good times are tight. Or he's not saying, plus, if you start helping those people, pretty soon, they're going to start expecting it, and then what are you going to do, right? In fact, there are some politicians who think the best way to help those kind of people is to cut them off. Let them learn to start doing things for themselves. Don't help them more, help them less. But see, John's not having it. He's got a pretty narrow view of this issue, if you ask me. How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses to help? Now, I mean, I'll just be honest with you. I like conditional sentences. If the brother or sister in need seems redeemable, then you should help. Or if he's an American citizen who appears to bathe semi-regularly, then it's okay. Help. Go ahead. If she keeps having babies when she can't afford it, then you don't need to worry about her. If they were smart and got a good fixed interest rate mortgage they could afford, then maybe they're worth helping. See, conditions. They're simple, really. If this, then that. If not this, I don't got to worry about it. But John's not into conditional sentences. He's full of declaratives. Do this, whether or not that. He says, little children, let us love in truth and action. Obey God's commandments. Love those in need. I mean, I'd love to find some wiggle room in there for you, but I'm afraid I can't help. Mother Teresa, the saint of the gutters, who gave herself to the dying on the streets of Calcutta, had a hard time following God. I mean, you'd think with the spiritual superstars that it'd be easy, right? But as most of us have probably heard already, Mother Teresa struggled mightily with her faith. Regularly questioned the existence of God, feeling alone and isolated, abandoned by the one she felt called to serve. But in spite of the doubts that would paralyze most people, serve is exactly what she did. In August 1982, Pope John Paul sent her to war-torn Beirut. If you remember Beirut in 1982, the Pope sent her there so that the victims of the war would know of his solidarity with them. The Mother Teresa determined shortly to go into the heart of the killing fields in West Beirut to rescue this small group of victims. And of course, everybody warned her against going in there. It's too dangerous. I mean, she's only going to be able to help just a handful of people. It's really not worth it. And Mother Teresa did what she was so famous for doing. She ignored them and said she'd pray for a ceasefire. On August 12th at 4 o'clock, she lit a candle that she'd brought with her to Beirut, and she started praying. At 5 o'clock, the shooting stopped. And shortly thereafter, she went to a place where there were 38 Muslim children between the ages of 7 and 21, and they were all mentally or physically handicapped, all starving, dirty, and frightened, for all practical purposes, abandoned and left for dead. And she organized their extraction from the war zone. And 2 days later, she went back and she brought out 27 more children. Now, before she came, nobody wanted these kids. Too sick, too much trouble, too much else going on. After her journey into West Beirut, however, people began to step up. Neighbors started bringing food, and pretty soon the government officials and the doctors showed up. One of the Red Cross officials who admitted quite candidly that his initial reaction to Mother Teresa's presence had been that a saint was not what was most needed. Afterwards, acknowledged that he'd been astonished at the efficiency and the energy that went hand in hand with her version, her brand of spirituality. She was, he said, a cross between a military commander and Saint Francis. I like that. Mother Teresa, in her 1979 Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, said, "It is not enough for us to say, I love God, but I do not love my neighbor. Since in dying on the cross, God made himself the hungry one, the naked one, the homeless one. Jesus' hunger," she said, "is what you and I must find and alleviate." Well, that's how Mother Teresa said it. The way John said it was, how does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses to help? Little children, let us love not in word or in speech, but in truth and action. So how do we know love? According to John, we know it when we see it.